kalta me hale kaleya ui kui hule kaleya ui kui.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project. This program is balancing life, dancing in time, practicing native spiritual traditions in contemporary California. If you go to the anthropological literature, you'll find a lot of information about the details of native ceremonies.
When eating and bathing, the priest prayed for money, for himself. His only motive and
these writings are referred to as the final word about native ceremonial life, but their interpretations were not always accurate.
The dance was just for pleasure and just for a good time. When preparing for the jump dance, the rich man who
they were written from a cultural perspective that was foreign to native people and often very biased. They rarely expressed a spiritual understanding of what they observed. Some of these writings are now being reevaluated by scholars with the help of native people. One thing turn-of-the-century anthropologists believed was that they were observing the final days of native culture. Time has proved that idea wrong, and throughout Northern California today, traditions are still a part of the everyday lives of native people. California natives may not look any different from other people of their generation, but they are dedicated to maintaining their culture, religion, and ceremonies. I'm Neil Harvey. On this program, producer Joseph Orozco introduces us to his Hupa community and the importance of living life by the ceremonial calendar.
I'm Joseph Orozco. I'm Natinawe, a person from Natinup, the place where the trails return. This place is now known as the Hupa Valley Reservation in Northern California, and my tribe is known as the Hupa. Together with four other Northwestern California peoples, the Yurok, Karuk, Cholula, and Wiyot, we're known as the High Dance Tribes because we carry on a similar and interrelated ceremonial dance cycle, as we have done for thousands of years. In the following program, Native people from several tribes will share with you some of their own extremely personal feelings about participating in religious practices that are as old as the land itself and just as alive. Before we began taping interviews, many people were hesitant to do this. We were concerned about adding to the misinformation of the general public. You won't find any instructions here on how to hold a ceremony or how to do an Indian dance. But if you listen respectfully, something may touch you. And that's how it should be.
So anyway, what I'm trying to say is there were things happened in the dance within me. And I don't know whether this is the stuff that you put on tape, whether this is the stuff that you tell people about. I share stuff like this that is, you know, personal with when the occasion comes up, I guess, or when, I guess for a better word, I always use scripture. That is, you never cast your pearls before swine. And that would eliminate a tape recording, because when you share what you have that is so sacred to you in your own heart and soul, you share it with another because something is making you share it. And you're sharing it because you have a feeling to, you want to. It's something that you're going to, for a reason. But once it hits something like this, they can play this any place. They can poke fun and laugh. And I'm not saying it's wrong, because somebody else might hear it and get something out of it. So.
In the 1830s, American miners, soldiers, settlers, and preachers arrived in our homelands. Although we escaped the utter decimation inflicted on California Native people south of us, we suffered much. It became difficult and dangerous to practice our own ways of life. Some of our dances were discontinued for many years, but they never died. The Hupa white deerskin and the jump dances were reinstated in the late 30s, and except for being called off briefly during World War II, have been held without a break since the late 40s. The Yuroks renewed their jump dance in 1985. The Karuks went back to their jump dance grounds in 1994 after a 99-year lapse. As I begin this story, I wanted to find out about what it takes to bring back a dance, a ceremony that may have not been held for nearly a century, like the Karuk jump dance. I was politely but firmly set straight by the dance leaders I talk with. No, we can't talk about those things for the public. The story I found, the story I was honored to be given, is the story of what it means to practice a physically demanding, time-consuming religion in this day and age, the kind of hope and personal commitment it takes to live on a ceremonial calendar and still hold down a job, raise children, and exist in the modern world.
I do think there's a lot we can talk about, particularly the reasons why and the things you hope to accomplish with putting ceremonies back.
Terry Sapahan, Karuk. He's a business consultant, father, former tribal councilman. He has been involved with reinstating the Karuk Jump Dance, held for the first time this century in 1994.
Because obviously there are things we can't talk about, but there is a great deal that I think we can, and that stuff that we can't talk about is even part of the ongoing and contemporary debate with bringing dances and ceremonies back, and some people thinking that you can't do it because if something happened hundreds of years ago, you couldn't bring something back now because no one saw that, which I don't believe is true, because I think the wisdom that exists in the mountains and in the rivers and in the rocks of these places still resides in those places.
I felt I didn't have the knowledge that it took to dance. And after dancing the first year, I could see that it was important. So I felt that I would need more knowledge for participating in the dance. So I've been in training for about a year and a half.
Ed Chase, Sinagwe. He's a father of two. He works full-time for the Caltrans. He's a dedicated jump dancer, and he's also an elkhorn carver.
If you're interested in your religion, if you're interested in your dance, you can come there and you can learn. And that's all. You know, a lot of us wanted to do was learn. I didn't have the opportunity when I was young, and I have the opportunity now, and I'm making the most of it. The old people, they were there for a purpose, and I feel I'm there for a purpose. And there's people my age in their 40s that have a desire to bring that back, and that's why I got involved, is because I felt that same need to bring that back. It's my religion. We have to make that as positive as we can. And that's what I will do with the rest of my life.
The Karuk Jump Dance happens every year along the Klamath River. The Hoopa High Dances happen every other year along the Trinity River. George Porty Blake, Hoopa tribal member, is an internationally known artist. He sculpts, casts ceramics, and he also makes traditional dance regalia. He has strong feelings about the Hoopa Deerskin Dance.
It's a wonderful dance. It's an experience that, if you're fortunate enough to experience it, you know, and a lot of people look at it, probably wish they could. There's probably a lot of people not even connected to this culture anyway, would probably love to do that, be a part of it somehow.
When you're there, you are part of it, even if you simply stand and watch. There's usually a lot of visitors to the Hoopa dances, but the feelings people have for their religious ceremonies are very private. What Kayleen Sisk Franco went to from the Mount Shasta area has to say is true for us too.
These ceremonies are heal the people. If you're married to an Indian person, or you have kids who are Indian kids, then you should be there. You should come and you should participate. But if you're just coming in to say, let's go see what those Indians are doing, you shouldn't be there. You know, let the Indians have their time. Let them help themselves. Let them heal themselves. Allow them that. Don't make a spectacle. You know, don't come in and think you're going to get something. Because that's not what it's about.
It's about respect. These are not just cultural events. While they are a part of the culture identifiable to Northern California, for those of us who participate, the high dances are a living religion, a way of life. Anthropologist A.L. Krober wrote about many California tribes, including ours. His books have diagrams of dance patterns and musical scales of songs he heard. His writings hold strings of misinterpretations that create an image in people's minds that Indians are very superstitious. He implies that tribal people believed bad things would happen if everything was not done in a certain order. Even the names we use in English were given by anthropologists and reflect the inaccuracy of their views. Each of the five high dance tribes have their own names for the dances in their own language. Anthropologists who witnessed and later wrote about these dances called one the white deerskin dance because part of it is done with decorated deerskins on poles. The skins used at the time were albino, thus the name white deerskin. However, while albino deer are rare and valued by the people, the tribes used other colored deerskins as well. The hoopa name for this dance literally translates to the summer dance along the river. The other high dance was called jump, or jumping dance, by the anthropologist, because at one point, the line of dancers jump off the ground. In hoopa, this dance is called the winter dance along the river. Renee Stauffer is Karuk from the Orleans area. She has two teenage daughters, works in tribal forestry, and she is what's called a medicine woman. She trained to carry the medicine for the Karuk jump dance in 1995.
Last year after the dances, spirituals asked me to do that. A lot of people are going to say, oh yeah, right. But that's what happened. And at first I thought, me? Why me? Who am I? You know? And then I thought, well, why not? So I decided to do it.
There are a lot of misconceptions about Indians and spirituality, about the powers of Indian spiritual leaders. Some non-Indians create very powerful images in their minds of something that we are not, like Greek gods or something. But for us, being a spiritual person or a leader is a responsible role, a way of living that personifies the teachings of the religion. We are all everyday human beings. The dances bring out the teachings, the lessons of life. This is your religion. This is your responsibility. It is placed before the people as their role, if they're going to be a high dance person or not.
Anybody can be spiritual. It's where your heart is. It's opening up to that. You're not some spirit, you know. I think they sort of have that sort of, like you have all this power and you know, you can, you know, use that power however you want. And that's not necessarily true. We're just humans. We can do whatever, you know, the spiritual bosses want or what we want to allow ourselves, how involved we want to get in it.
We're just human beings. We're involved whoever we allow ourselves to be. But what does it take to follow a ceremonial calendar and earn a living?
It's hard to balance all of that out. I work for Caltrans, and in the wintertime I'm working all the time, and summertime we do a lot of work too. So it's hard to have enough time to carve and pray and gather and do all those things. But there's a desire that pushes me and my family to do these things. It's just either you do or you don't. Simple as that.
I think we're very religious people, but I don't think that you could have really pulled out an individual concept like theology or religion. I think it was rolled up very tightly into our everyday life.
At some time in the past when all five tribes held 10-day high dances, each tribe in turn danced on their spiritual grounds, and each other tribe helped out by sending dancers, regalia, food, and prayers. The spiritual dance calendar during those summer months must have been quite full. Before roads were built for wagons and trucks, people traveled by dugout canoe, transporting all their food and regalia, a journey of many days depending upon the destination. With modern roads and vehicles making it easier to prepare for the dance and feed many people, it seems like the dances have actually become more complicated. In decades past, the menu consisted of what was easy to carry by hand: dried fish, dried venison, acorn meal, and a few wild vegetables. People back then cooked in baskets and ate sitting on the ground. Today you find picnic tables balanced on the rough ground, and you eat off china plates. The tables hold a full course meal of green salads, fruit salads, pasta salads, sliced tomatoes, cooked green beans and corn, fresh salmon, venison stew, roast turkey, fresh bread, pies, cakes, casseroles, chili beans, coffee and Kool-Aid, as well as the dried fish, and always warm acorn soup. The long tables are endlessly replenished as people take turns getting their fill. No sooner does someone rise from eating than their plate is whisked away to be washed by a crew of young women, and a clean table setting replaces it, ready for the next diner. The dances couldn't happen without the women who do all this. Renee Stauffer.
It was a lot of work, because we feed all of the people who come into camp, but it all worked out okay. It was really rewarding. I really enjoyed it. I liked the social part of it, the visiting with the people and, you know, all the socializing that goes on.
Before the people can eat, a dance must be held. There is no time set to dance. It just all comes together. The songs of the high dances usually have no lyrics. By and large, the songs of the high dances are harmonic sounds. In all dance, the songs are prayers, and owned by the singer or the singer's family. The dances are done without the use of instruments, no drums, no rattles, no clapper sticks. The deerskin dance has one singer in the center and two helpers, one on each side of the singer. The jump dance has two singers and a center man. The center man keeps the rhythm of the dance by the pace of his steps. The other men in line maintain the same stepping pace as the center man, their bare feet thumping against the ground in unison. Words cannot efficiently describe the vision of the dancers walking barefoot in a single line towards the dance ground. You hear them before you see them. Some items they wear are 100 years old. Some items are new. It's not until they're actually on the dance grounds that you recognize just who is who. Before then, the liner dancers seem to be the spirit image of the regalia they wear. In the Karuk jump dance, the girls, the purity dancers, lead ahead of the men dancers. The line winds its way to the dance grounds, where the medicine fire burns. The medicine people wait.
It's really something when you sit there and you see the dancers. You can hear them way before you see them. You hear the girls' dresses coming up the hill, and so you're sitting there anticipating, and to watch each one come up, crest over the hill, and come around, and you just feel so good.
This year, when we danced, as we were going up the trail, David was carrying the lantern, and the light reflected back on the head rolls, and it was just the red scarlet, and I think of that a lot. That line of men going up that hill could go back for centuries, going through that same process of going to the dance ground.
When they're dancing with the mountains, with the fir trees, and you hear those thump along as they're coming up that hill, and see them swaying as they're coming up the hill. That's a powerful thing. It's real emotional.
Dancing in line, it's a great feeling when you can hear just one voice. You don't hear this echo of somebody just a little bit out of time. It's so powerful. And everyone's moving the same way, and you finish it, and it's tiring. It's so tiring. The movements are really simple, but to do them gracefully and with heart, it takes a lot of effort, and you don't realize that until you're leaving. You think, wow, it's over. You don't want it to be over, but you're glad it is over. And then you're walking up the trail back to camp, and there's a sense of pride.
Whoa! Ho!
It's in my memory.
It seems to me one of the great privileges of Indian childhood is going to the dances. It's like summer camp, culture camp, learning by doing, all rolled into one. If you're a little person, no one tells you to get out of the dirt. If you're a little older and can find someone to supervise, you get to spend hot afternoons swimming in a river. If you're eligible, you may be allowed to dance. And despite the work you're expected to help with, there's a lot of time to play cards with your brothers, sisters, cousins, and friends. As long as young people participate, there's always hope for the future.
I hope that they become focused and that they make it a part of their lives and that they live what they believe in. I always hear people say, the way you act at the dances will be how you'll be all year long. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, because they can be really nice during the dances, and as soon as dances are over, they turn back to their old mean self. And for the young people, I'd like to see them focus on the religion, their spiritual being, and make it a part of their lives. When their children come, that'll be a part of their lives, and it'll continue to grow. And the dance will be stronger and better.
Well, I hope that they take away from the dance the feeling that the togetherness of the people there participating, dancing to bring better things throughout the year, to balance the earth, and that's what I hope. I can only do my part and hope that there's enough people with the right feelings to continue these dances in the right way.
For teenage girls, there is a very special role. They are known as purity dancers. Jessica Stauffer, Karuk, graduated from high school this year. I talked with her about dancing.
Well, I'm certainly proud of what you did there. It was really, really nice dancing there in that line with you, and good to see you out there. And
good to see you out there, too. It's cool that lots of people dance, too. People you don't usually see dance this time, and it was neat. It, like, changed a lot of people. Or not really changed them, but, like, affected a lot of people. I guess you could say it that way. It was neat.
Ed Chase talks about his daughter, Miranda, dancing in line.
I'm always excited when I see her in her regalia. Proud that we as a family are there in respect that, you know, my father, we never participated in the dances. He was an athlete and had his own thing that he participated in. And for me to be his only son, to have our family participate and my daughter out there in a line, is it makes me very proud.
Terry Sapahan.
I think the same issues that we wrestle with in this day and age are the same things that Indian people wrestled with 1,000 years ago. Had the same wants and needs and desires and weaknesses and strengths are played out. That whole human drama, I think, is played out today as it was a long time ago. I think it's always been like that. I think there's work that's always a part of it. Sometimes I think people expect things to be given to them or handed to them, and this ceremony and all of our ceremonies require people to make an effort. Each and every one of us who participate, who attend, aren't sitting on the sidelines watching something. We may be on the sidelines, but it's incumbent upon us to be a part of it with our prayers, our thoughts, our intentions, our actions, because I think that that's how it was a long time ago.
Another thing that hasn't changed over time is the sense of spirit the high dances have for the people. For all the changes, all the difficulties, it remains a profound transformative experience, connecting us to our past and to our future.
We've evolved to the different things that happen in everybody's lives. We work nowadays. We do lots of different things. There's television. And we have to adjust to all these different things and continue on in a positive manner. That's what that dance is. That's what the high dances are positive people coming together and doing positive things for a positive outcome.
Wearing the regalia, people have said they kind of were not themselves. The big woodpecker scalp headdresses, the necklaces that seem to have a song of their own, the jump dance baskets with their designs, all the spirits of that regalia move people sometimes to tears. When you're fasting, you're praying, you're dancing, you're doing it for the right reasons. It's got to be good.
The kahunai are there. They're watching. I feel that the people that are participating want to be as friendly and open and committed as they can. That's what makes a better prayer. There is a group of people that are committed to that dance, and it's a good feeling to be a part of that.
Porty Lake.
I've heard the spirit. I've seen it. I saw the spirit hit a man starting practice song in Upper Norton Field, that a hush just fell on the camp. So it's almost like in awe, mouth just fell open. And it wasn't the same when he danced in the dance hall. there was something there that just unexpectedly hit just at that time, and it was glorious. It's just an experience that I'm so glad I was there at that time. It brings back to mind, and you see kids sitting down in the deerskin dance, last dance out there in front, and here was this guy that sang, we knew, singing as a younger man, he's still alive, singing as a younger man, he had a lot of volume. But it wasn't just volume that made it ring out through that, under that canopy of oaks. So we'd look back and we'd see these old people sitting out in front and tears just running down. There was something happening there in sound of your ears that makes you always want to call back that same experience, that emotion, that feeling that was... It had to be God in someplace there. How else could you explain it?
When the spiritual people pray during ceremonies, they always remind us, these prayers are for all the people, everywhere. These prayers are for the whole world. If you, the listener, have been in attendance at a ceremony, even to simply watch, your thoughts, your intentions, your prayers would be a part of it. So in a way, by listening to this radio program, you have also become a part of it. When someone tells you a story, they give you the responsibility of knowing it, using it, sharing it. This program is a part of the story of what we, California Native people, are about. But the words of the medicine woman are important. Anyone can be spiritual. It's where your heart is. We hope you will choose to take on the responsibility of knowing where your heart is, in your own community, in your own way, in your own family. Join us in healing and fixing the world.
Balancing life, dancing in time, practicing Native spiritual traditions in contemporary California. This program was written and produced by Joseph Orozco. Executive producer Peggy Berryhill. Project director Roby Cook. Digital editing and mixing Neil Harvey. Engineering assistance provided by KIDE-FM. The music of Koljidimo appears in our opening theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the California Council for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Lannan Foundation, the Leff Foundation, the Vanguard Public Foundation, the Seventh Generation Fund, the Fund for Folk Culture in partnership with the James Irvine Foundation, and the Robeson Fund. Special thanks to the Klamath Trinity Indian Education Program for the use of their Lightbrush dance song and demonstration regalia, and to Jim Allen for reading the Kroeber text. Special thanks also to all those who both agreed and declined to be interviewed for this program. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.